Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. In his famous book, Democracy in America, published in 1835, Alexis de Tocqueville wrote the following: "By the side of every religion is to be found a political opinion, which is connected with it by affinity." Tocqueville understood that it was difficult for many people to separate their religious beliefs and values from their political attitudes and actions. Nonetheless, he argued that the success of American democracy in the early 19th century rested upon a separation of church and state. Today in America, it is widely accepted or believed that the separation of church and state, emanating from a particular reading of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, implies that clergy should refrain from becoming entangled in the political process. We explored this theme in an earlier podcast with Eric Stanley of the Alliance Defense Fund, who detailed where this modern notion of an apolitical clergy comes from. In that interview, we learned that the creation of 501c3 status for nonprofit organizations came with the condition that tax-exempt groups must refrain from endorsing any political candidate. But what does that mean for the free speech rights of clergy members? Are they to avoid any discussion of political issues when sermonizing from the pulpit? Should they steer clear of specific endorsements of candidates, political parties, and/or legislation when speaking in an official capacity for their church? Given the expansiveness of government nowadays, is it even possible for clergy to avoid political discussions? And do pastors who speak openly on political themes risk alienating their church membership? Today's podcast represents an extension of our earlier discussion with Eric Stanley. But whereas Mr. Stanley came at these issues from the vantage point of a lawyer, I thought it'd be worthwhile to hear from a member of the clergy on this topic. As such, I am pleased to be joined by Joe Featon, senior pastor of Cedar Park Church in Bothell, Washington. He is the author of numerous books on a wide array of theological topics, and in 2007, Reverend Featon was featured in God's Christian Warriors, a CNN documentary examining the interplay of religion and politics. Pastor Joe, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much.
Let's begin with your background. As I understand it, your first professional calling was not the ministry, but rather to the political arena. If you could inform us a little bit about that.
Well, I can't say that it was a calling, but it was an interest. From the time I was an elementary school student until I was in the university, I intended to go into politics. In fact, I was going to run for president in the year 2004. And in my high school annual, my friend signed it, "I'll vote for you in 2004.
So, did you get that vote?
I'm not sure.
You bet right in.
I did make it to the White House in 2004, but it was for the prayer, National Day of Prayer, which the president has subsequently canceled. But anyway, so that was my goal. I got an undergraduate degree in political science and pursued that. I worked in the Oregon legislature as an intern and as a lobbyist there. And so I was chairman of the College Republicans in the state of Oregon back in the day. But then when God called me to the ministry while I was a university student, that resulted in the change. So I moved from the ambition of politics to what I felt was the call of God toward ministry.
And when did this call come about?
Well, actually, it was in my room at Willamette University. I was praying one Friday night, and I said to God, "God, I want you to talk to me out of this book and about what you want me to do, and I'm going to get up and I'm going to read it until you do." Mm-hmm. And so I got out of my bed that night and started to read, and I read out of Daniel chapter 12, just a couple of verses that say, "They that turn many to righteousness shall be as the stars that shine forever and ever." And when I read those words, God spoke to my life.
That's
and,
interesting.
By the way, my roommate in that year was Jim Albaugh, who is the president of the Boeing Corporation now. So,
wow. Yeah. All right. Very, it's interesting how you get these connections and very successful
world.
People.
So explain to us, that was in the early 1970s, if I'm correct?
That's correct.
And how did your career then progress in the ministry from that point?
Well, that was part of the Jesus Revolution back in those days. And while I was still a student, we put on the Sweet Jesus Prince of Peace Rock Festival, the first of its of the Jesus festivals in America, and had about 5,000 people that showed up for that. So that actually kind of launched my ministry. And so for the first few months, I was kind of a youth evangelist, speaking on campus and speaking in churches and all of that. And then I, after that, I kind of entered the more regular service of the ministry. That is, I became a youth pastor and worked under other people until I was 30, and then kind of launched on my own. Kind of, I went the apprentice route in terms of the ministry.
Mm-hmm. Now, during your move into the ministry in the 1970s and setting up the Rock Festival and such, did you lose an interest in politics? Was that a background issue? Was it still forefront?
Well, it was actually, it drifted out of the picture quite a bit in those early days. And so, because I felt like that was what I was before, and now I was going to go into ministry. And so, you know, you kind of turn your back on one, because for me, it was kind of a decision. You know, I'd wanted to go into politics, but I felt God wanted me to do something different. So you're going to do God's will or your will. And mm-hmm. so I left that aside and pursued the work of the Lord and the ministry. But as it's turned out, you know, it's kind of come full circle, and I've been able to kind of re-enter, but from a different angle.
Well, before we talk about that different angle, now you became the pastor of Cedar Park here in 1981.
That's correct.
And give us a little background on Cedar Park Church, its denominational affiliation and your membership, how it's grown over the past couple decades.
Well, Cedar Park Church is a part of the Assemblies of God. The Assemblies of God is actually one of the largest denominations in the world, and growing at a very rapid rate. Out of every 10 people that become Christians in the world today, one out of 10 will be in an Assembly of God church. We're adding about 250,000 members a month around the world. So there's now about 60 million Assemblies of God people in the world. And we have, I think in the United States, about 33,000 ministers. So when I started at this church, it was a small church. I had one part-time secretary. And so it has grown substantially over the years and diversified. So we have about 500 employees now and several branch churches. We operate the largest evangelical school system in North America. We have two high schools and five elementary schools. We have a mechanic shop, a funeral home, a cemetery, a missionary auto program. We have a studio. We've got several state licensed counseling centers around the region, and drug and alcohol and various things. So it's diversified into a very, multifaceted kind of ministry. They don't normally measure churches against the nonprofits, but the last time I looked in Washington State, we would have been about the 16th largest nonprofit in the state. You know, I think we're just behind Planned Parenthood as a nonprofit. And so it's become a diverse ministry, I would say.
And when we talk about nonprofit, and we also talk about tax-exempt status that I had talked about in terms of my introduction, and we talked about the 501c3 status that a number of organizations have. One thing I want to clear up is, do you pay taxes at all, or is Cedar Park Church a completely tax-exempt organization?
Cedar Park as a church pays an enormous amount of tax. You know, we pay huge taxes, in my opinion, and we pay it in various ways. Last month, I think I signed $47,000 worth of property taxes. Mm-hmm. So in this state, you know, a church only gets 5 acres tax exempt, whereas other nonprofits get an infinite amount. So the Boy Scouts or all of these other nonprofits, it comes out of an early anti-Catholic prejudice in the legislature at the founding of the state. They wanted to limit the power of the Catholic Church, and they felt that property taxes was the way to do that. So we pay a lot of property taxes. We pay other kinds of, we pay sales tax, for example. When I built our most recent high school building, I paid to the state of Washington about $700,000 in sales tax to build a high school building. So our private school was taxed to pay for public education, and that's the way it goes. But so we pay all the sales taxes, really, and you'd pay UBIT and various other kinds of taxes.
And what is UBIT?
Unrelated business income tax.
Okay.
So the only thing we're exempt from are 5 acres of property on the for property tax, and but we have probably 250 acres altogether. So to have 5 acres exempt is next to nothing. And then we pay all your business and occupation taxes. So like when we sell a crypt, you know, you pay taxes on that, and we pay all the employment taxes, of course, and labor and industries, and you know, all employment taxes, all of that kind of thing. So we're really only exempt from federal income tax. We don't pay federal income tax unless it's unrelated to the business of the church. And that's really what we don't pay is federal income tax.
And I think this is a very important, it's very important to stress this aspect, because the general perception is that taxes are, or churches are completely tax exempt.
Yeah,
and that's the justification for, well, if you're not paying taxes, then you shouldn't enter the political arena. But again, if you're paying this many taxes, one would have to say that government policy, which will affect your tax bill, should certainly be an area in which you could discuss.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we pay taxes, but these days, of course, government also collects a lot of fees.
Right.
And so, you know, over at the one of our high schools, we have a hot dog machine. And so the county health department has to come out and check that machine and charge us $600 for the visit each year to have a look at it. Well, I mean, is that a tax, or what is that exactly?
Right.
And there's all kinds of fees like that. You know, you have your stormwater fee, and so you got to pay a fee for them to come out and look in your manholes, and decide if you've got too much dirt that's collected in the manhole of your stormwater system in your parking lot.
Right.
And so it's just truly there is an unbelievable amount of taxation on churches. And regulation upon churches.
We might bring that point up a little bit later and discuss that further. But I want to talk about how your two roads that divided in the 1970s came back once again. You decided to choose, instead of going down the path of politics, you chose the path of the ministry. And when did these two paths start crossing again for you?
Well, you know, I'd always do a 4th of July service, patriotic service there. I would do something at Memorial Day. I would do something on Labor Day. So just as a preacher, I would preach on themes that related to all of that. And so, and really there wasn't, when I was starting out in the 70s, there weren't really materials that were readily available. So I was digging this material out and teaching and preaching on basically the Christian foundation of America, and that we were a Christian nation, and that and so basically building support for the nation out of the, and for the faith, because I saw America and Christianity as complementary to each other, as we have historically been, in my view, at least during most periods of our history. And so, you know, you preach on those kinds of themes. On Columbus Day, I'd preach on, you know, Columbus's vision for America and the spiritual underpinnings of that. You know, he wanted to, you know, restore the Holy Land to the Jews, for example, and wanted to make a lot of money on his trips here so that he could, you know, do that kind of work. Well, you know, so what you find is that more and more, that several times a year in my preaching, I am preaching on themes that relate to America. And then you start seeing things drift in America. And so now you're preaching against this particular thing and that particular thing and calling America to repentance, you know, and
right,
to change. And so it isn't long until these things are definitely merging together from the pulpit, you know, as I preach on themes, as Americans always have. You know, they say that 80% of the political tracts in the American Revolution were recycled sermons or written by ministers. I mean, so the American Revolution has always been was a minister-driven kind of a revolution, and I carried that tradition on.
During this period of time when you're speaking on different days, 4th of July, Columbus Day, or speaking on different themes, was there ever a time when you step back and self-assessed and say, whoa, I don't know if I should be talking about these themes because I could jeopardize our tax-exempt status, or there's this environment in the United States that says clergy should avoid political themes? Did you ever think about that, and either explicitly or in the back of your head?
Well, I mean, yes, I think about it quite a bit, and I take just, you know, significant steps to make sure that I'm not vulnerable in that area. You know, for example, I don't know how many years, but probably for 20 years, I've done what I call pastor's picks, where I make voting recommendations. And in the old days, I would have someone, Dolly Coster's actually, she would come and I would print up my thing, and then she would take it, or I'd make it, you know, produce it, and then she would go down to Kinko's and copy it off and hand it out in the foyer of the church, or back, hand it out in the and the parking lot upon the car windows. And then I got to thinking about this, and as kind of as my profile went up, I thought, this, I could get in trouble for this. And so then I basically removed it from the church, and I would put disclaimers on anything I would say. You know, I'd say the church doesn't make endorsements, but I'm a citizen and I'm entitled to do it myself. And so these are purely my personal endorsements and have nothing to do with the church. And so I created a separate website, you know, that I paid for, you know, out of my own pocket. Actually, my son-in-law pays for it. And so we separated it all completely from the church, although I, you know, it's me. I mean, I'm a pastor. I work at her church. And so anybody and everybody knows that I do. I've been here 29 years, you know. And so, but yes, I have consciously tried to stay on the right side of the 501c3 regulations. I've been investigated by the IRS. You know, the thing about when you take controversial positions, your opponents don't have to fight you. They just complain to the government and get the government to fight you.
Right.
So there was a two-year period where we had 11 investigations here, all of them generated by political enemies who wanted to try to do me harm. You know, so the IRS, you know, came out and, you know, did a preliminary investigation. I mean, we demonstrated that we were on the right side of the law, but still, I mean, they hassle you. You know, I had the State Patrol and the Public Health Department show up here one day, come roaring into the parking lot, you know, with lights flashing, and because someone had reported that we were running a chop shop here. Well, we have a mechanic shop. But it's just harassment,
right?
You know, it's what it really is. And so they go through all your records and they investigate. Now, what do you do with your oil? So they have to, you have to show them your receipts. You've properly disposed of the oil, and all of the. I mean, so they just, so they use a complaint from a citizen who's really your political opponent, and the government comes out, harasses you, and wastes your time and your money. And then, you know, it's just like the old communist system, really.
Right.
I mean, it's what America's become. It's become a nation of communists running us and trying to harass the church. I mean, that's the way I think about it. And you know, when you've had 11 investigations in 2 years, and of course they turn up nothing because we are meticulous on the subject of following the law. And just to give you a further example of that, I have a management team meeting on every Wednesday. From 9:45 until probably about 12:30 or so. And so the various managers of the organization, but including our attorney, our CFO, our human HR director, you know, the business director, all we all get together. But I would say that not less than 1 hour of our 2.5 hour meeting is spent dealing with government-related issues. So we are always conscious of what the government wants from us, how they're trying to, what's the next level of harassment, you know, and it comes in a thousand forms. It can come through labor and industries. It can come through the Employment Security Division. But I mean, I have a full-time lawyer on our staff here, a full-time lawyer. And basically his job, I said, you know, make sure that we don't run afoul of the law. You know, make sure that we're clean in every regard. I mean, back in 2004, when I was helping the Bush-Cheney campaign, and I basically said to the attorney, I said, I want you to go through this organization with a fine-tooth comb and basically do the government's job better than they're going to do it, because I'm going to get involved in this campaign and I know they're going to come after me.
Right.
And so he went through everything, made sure we were clean in every way. You know, like even on my cell phone, for example, you know, most churches would provide their pastor with a cell phone. Well, I pay for my cell phone out of my own pocket because I know that from time to time, I'm going to get a phone call from a political person who is going to ask me some political question. And so I want to be able to say I paid for it out of my own pocket and the church didn't pay for that. I mean, that's how meticulous we are.
Right.
But you think about that environment. I mean, when you're always covering your backside because you don't want the government coming after you and, you know, and harassing you, and you don't want to see your name in the paper for some charge, because those guys, they're brutal. You know, they don't care if you're innocent or guilty. You know, if they're going to charge you and then find out if you're innocent or guilty. And of course, when you have political people on the other side who want to harass you, then they make hay out of that. And, you know, I mean, this is the environment that we're working in.
Mm-hmm.
This is the spiritual and the political environment that makes me think that we have a problem in the country with regard to separation of church and state.
It's an interesting question. In my own research, and I'm investigating how government regulates religious organizations, and as you mentioned, in ways that you normally would not think about, such as monitoring the hot dog stand and such. You know, Cedar Park is a very large church and has the resources to hire a full-time lawyer and deal with these situations, but a number of very small churches do not. And oftentimes it becomes merely a battle of attrition between the local government, which has all the time on its hands and a great deal of resources from taxpayer-funded lawyers and such, versus a small community church that's just trying to, you know, get started and move. And that can have a significant impact on whether that church grows or not.
Yeah, oh, exactly, because of the resources that it takes. I mean, it has an impact upon us,
mm-hmm.
but it's a price you have to pay. And we also feel that we should pay the price because for the sake of others behind us, because they're not everybody has the capability that we have,
right,
or the interest. And so we recognize that we are fighting battles for other churches, because we're involved in education, you know, that's a highly regulated area at a lot of different levels, actually. And so we, you know, like we just fought a fight with the state on whether or not in our preschool we actually got a religious exemption from the requirement to hire homosexuals. And you know, that, I mean, for a church to be coerced by the government into hiring people that you believe are sinners by their conduct, you know, so, I mean, for us to hire a homosexual, we would have to abandon our religious values.
Right.
We would have to abandon what we have a sense of in terms of the Word of God, the Bible, and what it requires of us. And so you think to yourself, what in the world is the state doing regulating this in the first place?
It seems like it's an area that, you know, government says we want to stay out of the content of religious messages, but that's a backdoor way of getting into that, essentially.
Yeah, well, yes. Well, if you're going to require who you're, if you're going to force who you're going to hire, that's not even a back door. That's a front door,
uh-huh.
because your message is delivered by people.
Right.
And you expect that your people are going to be consistent in their values with the message, not inconsistent with it.
Mm-hmm. Let me continue on and talk about you're talking about the different battles and how you've been involved in politics. Now, you've mentioned as well the your involvement in the 2004 Bush-Cheney campaign and your pamphlets called The Pastor's Picks. How else have you been involved in politics in the political arena over the past 20 or 30 years?
Well, primarily I endorse candidates. I've actually led a few campaigns. In 2008, I did the Huckabee campaign for Washington State. I was a volunteer chairman for that. In 2004, I did the Bush-Cheney thing. I've served on the steering committee for various senators. I'm currently on our senator candidates. I haven't had any successful ones yet. But I've served with, you know, helped out with various campaigns. And I did that in 2000, 2004, 2008, where I chaired or led some part of the presidential campaign locally. We did the May Day for Marriage rally back in 2004 to speak to issues of marriage. I led a political lobbying organization for a number of years, which called back then Washington Evangelicals for Responsible Government. I was president of that for about 10 or 12 years, I forget how long. And then that morphed into the Faith and Freedom Network, mm-hmm. which then I turned over to somebody else. But so I've done political lobbying, maintained a lobbyist. I've organized voter registration efforts in the state. We had our most successful one in 2004, but subsequently as well. So those are the kinds of involvements that I've had.
And roughly how much energy or time does this take of your regular duties on a day-to-day basis?
Well, not a great deal. I mean, I run everything that I do, I run through other people.
Right.
So, you basically oversee and manage and direct. I mean, that's how, for an organization like this, that's how you have to do everything. And so you basically recruit the people and give them direction. So, you know, you have a weekly meeting or a monthly meeting depending on the season, but mostly you oversee by consultation, give direction to people mm-hmm. like that.
Let me also ask, and I meant to ask this a few minutes ago, but I'm a good time to steer this back to the discussion, but you mentioned when you were in a battle with the state government over hiring of homosexuals in your preschool.
Right.
You had mentioned previous to that, too, that you felt that your church was a vanguard for a number of other churches that couldn't fight these battles. To what extent do you work with other organizations or smaller churches when you're fighting these kinds of battles?
Well, I don't typically work with other smaller churches mm-hmm. in doing that. I mean, we've worked together. We've worked with the Catholic Church, for example, on back when Ron Sims and King County wanted to shrink this or diminish the capability of the size of churches in the county to 20,000 square feet.
Right, and that was back in 2001.
I forget what year that was. But yeah, so we worked with them on a collaborative effort. I didn't lead that. Actually, the Archbishop led that, but I participated in it. And then, when we have legal issues, some legal issues we handle ourselves. Generally, we do that because we have our own in-house attorney and have good access to others. And we have occasionally also linked up with the Alliance Defense Fund and their attorneys. And so when I was a plaintiff in suing the state on this domestic DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act.
Right.
And so that was handled by other attorneys, and we were in a cooperative effort, So, we do a little bit of collaborative work, but some of it we just do ourselves.
But it seems that a lot of smaller churches do benefit from your actions, though.
Well, I think so, yes, because we plow the field and... Mm-hmm. We're a blocker for them.
Speaking of the Alliance Defense Fund, we recently had a podcast with Eric Stanley talking about the Pulpit Initiative.
Right.
And were you a participant in that at all?
I can't remember if I was or not. I'm not. I don't think I was. That was where we all decided to be obnoxious for one Sunday. And then,
it was in September before the 2008 general election.
Yeah. Well, I don't remember if I signed on to that or not, because I generally qualify for that without signing on.
Let me explore this a little bit and take it in a different direction in terms of your activity is very well known. You've been plaintiffs in lawsuits. You've been forefront of campaigns, running different lobbying organizations, as you have mentioned. How does this relate to your membership? And I think before we even talk about that, how the membership, your parishioners relate to that. Give us an idea of what the Cedar Park membership is like, and also the Bothell community where you minister. What are we talking about here? Is this highly Republican, highly Democrat? Is it a mix of the two? What do we have?
Well, I would say this area would be called a swing district, speaking politically, that like our state representatives, we have a state senator who's Democrat, two state representatives who are Democrat. It's been, since the 94 revolution that we had a Republican, and they lasted for a few years, but then were lost, I think, probably 4 or 6 years later. So it tends, I would say it has tended to be Democrat in the last few years here, but I would think it's still considered a swing district.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't looked at the presidential numbers to know which way they went the last few years in this district, but it would be fairly Democrat. I mean, we are a suburb of Seattle, and the suburbs in the ring around Seattle have been tending toward Democrat in the last few years. They used to be Republican, but they've definitely turned into swing districts in more recent years. So, and our church, I've never actually polled our church to find out whether they're mostly Republican or Democrat, but I could almost guarantee you they're mostly Republican.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many people do you draw to a Sunday service or Sunday services each week?
You know, that varies, but I would say that Cedar Park, the Bothell campus, we would have 1,000 to 1,200 on a given Sunday. On a big Sunday, it goes up, you know, like Easter and special days and such. Campus, system-wide, will be up to a couple of thousand, you know, with all the branches and pieces like that. So Sunday services, and of that group, I would say we would definitely be a majority Republican. But, you know, the exit polls from the recent elections show that if you go to church, you are going to be 67% Republican nationwide.
Right.
And I think that would be even equally or more so here. And if you don't go to church, you're going to be Democrat by a similar kind of number. So the very fact that by all standards that we are at least 67% Republican, honestly, I would think we're closer to 90% Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who's a Democrat is definitely not going to say so.
The branch campus aspect is very interesting to me. We're going to explore this with a few other churches that do this in some other upcoming podcasts. But how does that work? Do you video cast to other branch campuses, or are there separate pastors there that do the services? How does that operate?
Well, we actually do it with separate lead pastors. Okay. So even though they're branches of Cedar Park, they have their own lead pastor. I mean, we're related to them. I mean,
right.
Obviously one corporation and all of that, and I appoint them. But I also do one video venue, they call it, and to where I am broadcast separately by video, live video into that service. So we would do a little bit of both.
It's interesting. It's fascinating for me. My own church, which is a small church in Duval, doing video cast to Arizona, which is just an amazing way to think about church organization and church planting nowadays with the internet and networking type abilities.
Well, it's definitely changing.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think the internet and the online church is definitely going to increase. Mm-hmm. I haven't done it yet, but in terms of producing online church, but I have people who watch our service. I mean, where we obviously webcast, but so we have people in other states who watch the service.
Right.
By, you know, video streaming and all of that. But we haven't turned it into a conscious service yet.
And speaking of the services, how much do you engage in political discussion? I know that you had mentioned your pastor's pick pamphlets no longer are handed out in the lobby and such. But beyond the issue of candidates, do you frequently touch upon hot-button social issues that are coming up for referendum, or, as you mentioned, the Defense of Marriage Act that was hot here in the Seattle area about a year or two ago. How often do you deal with services that deal or touch that with political issues in your services?
Well, I mean, I would almost never devote a full service to it.
Okay.
I would, and I actually rarely do I preach a sermon. I mean, I can't recall the last time I preached a sermon on a topic that would be considered political. You know, I might have brief mentions of things. Like, you know, a couple of weeks ago I was preaching on the nature of the Antichrist, and I spoke a little bit about Islam there. In that Islam denies that Jesus is the Son of God. The Quran says God didn't have a son. And so, you know, I suppose, is that political to speak of Islam as an antichrist religion? I suppose that's political, but I don't think of it as political.
Right.
Or when I was preaching on Joseph the other day, I noted that Joseph advised the Pharaoh to take over all of the assets of everybody's business and to basically take control of agriculture and everything. So, you know, I couldn't resist a little bit of a reflection on that, you know, but it's more occasional shots, I would say,
right,
that I fire rather than ongoing sermons or teaching.
Right. And how does the membership respond? I mean, not only, so you mentioned you don't overtly bring political issues into the sermons, but nonetheless, you're a public figure. People know where you're coming from. You may take an action and appear in the news one day on the Defense of Marriage Act or something of that nature. Do you hear from your parishioners on this?
Well, yes, sometimes. I mean, and generally speaking, it would be supportive. You know, I get, I also get feedback from other people, mostly outside the church, actually, where I'll get negative feedback. Mm-hmm. I would only, on the rarest of occasions, get negative feedback from the congregation. I mean, first of all, I think the congregation knows me and they hear me. And even if they disagree with something that I've said, I mean, you try to have a style of communication that doesn't say, hey, it's either my way or the highway.
Right.
You know, and on political things, especially candidates, I will say, you know, I don't claim that this is a revelation from God. You know, I don't claim a divine support for my recommendations. And I just tell people how I arrive at my conclusions, you know, that I try to look for competent Christians. If I can't find that, I'll look for a conservative. If I can't find a conservative, then I will settle for a party, you know, unless the, you know, and so I have a hierarchy and people know kind of what that hierarchy is. But I mean, I have had people leave the church from time to time over the years. I probably have had some who haven't come to the church because of my political views. I got the presidential award at Northwest University a couple of weeks ago, and after the graduation, a lady comes up to me and says, "I'm your enemy," you know. And I said, "Really? I don't even think I even know you." But But, you know, she was a lesbian, and so she wanted to see herself as my enemy. I mean, it's absurd, but nonetheless, right. that was her perspective on it. And so, I mean, you do get a little bit of that kind of pushback from time to time.
Do you see it the other way? Do you see people becoming more attracted to your church because of your political actions, or you meet people, say, at a Northwest university and says somebody coming up to you and say, hey, I'm your enemy, but wow, I didn't know this was your views on things. I'd like to come to your church. Do you find that goes in the opposite direction?
I mean, it goes that way too. I mean, you definitely get people that that want to be supportive of a particular viewpoint. They know what that viewpoint would be. And so, yes, I mean, I've had people join our church because of some of those things as well.
Do you find that for members who come to Cedar Park primarily thinking about religion, they want the religious experience, they want to get in touch with God, do you have any evidence or have you seen people change their political views over time because of their faith?
Yes, that happens. You know, I'm thinking of a lady who was a staunch Democrat all of her life. And I probably get two emails from her a day now that she is radical right. So she has, in the period of years that she's been here, gone from a left-wing Democrat to a right-wing Republican.
And is that just, you know, rare folks, or is that, do you see that or get a sense that this happens quite frequently?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I only have anecdotal evidence to that. I will say that the Assemblies of God is unique in terms of denominations, in that we are the only denomination where the ministers are more conservative than the laity.
Mm-hmm.
So we do tend to influence toward conservative. We are a conservative in every way. You know, mm-hmm. we're religiously conservative, we're politically conservative as a group. Mm-hmm. Now, do we have our people that are Obama people that are AG Assemblies of God ministers? Actually, yes. But we all talk about them.
Right.
Try to get them saved.
It's an absolutely fascinating point. I think this deserves a research project in and of itself. One of the things we attempt to do here on Research on Religion is to not only explore different research topics, but to suggest ones for future study.
Yeah.
And it would seem that that would be interesting.
Well, I think, though, the political views of the clergy and then the political views of the professors of religion at religious institutions,
right.
I think that would be a very interesting and revealing study.
It does seem that way, where you tend to see divinity school faculty drift more toward the religious left
right.
over time. You think in Princeton Theological Seminary
right.
or such, as compared to the in-the-trenches laity, or excuse me, in-the-trenches clergy. In that regard, again, it is an interesting topic to think about. You know, to what extent are people coming to your church being transformed, and what that transformation involves, or is it a self-selection bias? People say, "Oh, well, you know, I do want to go to church, but you know, I know Pastor Joe has been in the news recently working on the Bush campaign, so I think I'm going to go down the street to the Presbyterian church instead." So it'd be interesting to get a feel for that. Now, you mentioned, let's talk about this a little bit more, about the clergy involvement in politics, and talk about the religious right. And a lot of ink has been spilled on the religious right, especially since the 1980s. It's a movement that really starts taking shape in the late 1960s through the 1970s. But scholars discover this and are exploring this quite in depth. To what extent do you think, from your own personal experience, and when we look at surveys, we tend to see people who attend church more, irrespective of denomination, although there's some denominational effect, tend to be much more conservative than liberal. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. I mean, why is the Assemblies of God more conservative?
Yeah, maybe that's a specific area to talk about.
Well,
yeah.
I think there's a kind of a collection of concepts. If you believe the Scripture as authoritative, which we do, as our rule of faith and practice, then something outside of yourself, it governs you. Similarly, you take a conservative view of the Constitution in a similar way. that as the Bible governs the church, so the Constitution governs the community, the country. Whereas a liberal doesn't think the Bible should govern the church. They follow their own enlightened ways. And similarly, a political liberal, you know, they have more enlightenment, so they want to change the Constitution into a living document that changes to suit their current opinions on the subject. And so there's commonality there. There's continuity between those kinds of concepts. And so the more conservative you are biblically, I think the more conservative you will be politically. Because a lot of the same things flow out of it. You know, if you believe that the Bible says those that don't work shouldn't eat, apart from those who are unable to work. You know, well, that's a conservative political idea as well, but it's a biblical idea.
Right.
You know, the idea that out of the Bible where Jesus taught that about principles of investment, you know, the parable of the talents,
mm-hmm.
you know, that a person should gain a return. Well, that's a very capitalist idea. And then the one who didn't take advantage of it, Jesus said, take it away. Take what he has away from him. Give it to somebody who will use it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, that is a very, and lots have been written about the, you know, the Protestant work ethic and the Protestant view of investment and all of that. But those come out of a belief in the Bible, about a belief in that it governs us. And I think that tends toward conservatism.
Mm-hmm. Let me also talk about the role of the religious right became very prominent in the 1980s during the Reagan administration. And one thing that I found interesting when I started exploring the topic in the 80s in my graduate work was Cal Thomas, who was prominent in the movement during the 1980s. I believe this was either late 80s or early 1990s. He came out and said, I think pastors have gotten too involved in politics in some regards, and we need to step back and focus on the faith again. Do you have any reflections on that? Is it possible to become too active or too attached to a particular party, to a particular candidate in that regard?
Well, I mean, I think his lens was pretty distorted. You know, I don't think he saw it accurately, and I think he was dealing with his own personal issues far more than reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he was connected with Thomas Rhode, you know, with Jerry Falwell and some of those guys. but he had his opinions. Mm-hmm. He's such an arrogant guy that he just annoys me in any case. But I don't really think he saw it accurately. Because the truth is that in the church, you know, we've always been conservative in the evangelical church. I mean, before anybody called it the religious right, it still was the religious right.
Right.
I mean, it didn't emerge in the 1980s. It had been there for a very long time.
Right. That's true. I mean, one could actually trace it back, the principles of it back several centuries in many regards.
Yeah, exactly. And so it just somebody came up with a handle that served to inform the uninformed about the nature of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't really think it changed all that much.
Mm-hmm.
I think that someone just gave visibility to it. And you know, the concept of the moral majority, that was an organization built by a person, you know, that gave identity to what a reality. But it wasn't creating something, it was only organizing something in a particular way. It had always been there, and any politician who had his wits about him was able to tap into that in times past.
Mm-hmm. Is there a danger, though, that if if a pastor becomes too linked to one particular party or one particular candidate, and that candidate fails, could that wash off back onto the church or the pastor himself?
Well, absolutely it can. You know, is it a question of a church becoming too connected to a party?
Yeah.
Or is it a question of one party better representing the values of the church? You know, I mean, we wouldn't have any issue supporting Democrats. In fact, we do have some Democrats in this state, you know, that are worth supporting. And and who are very very good in that regard. And so I think of Brian Sontag, you know, mm-hmm. our state auditor. He's a, I think of him as a conservative, you know, and a moral person.
Right.
And, you know, I like the treasurer from Snohomish County. And there's just various ones that are Democrats that are high-quality individuals that we can respect. But if, let's say, if you do identify closely with a party,
right.
as in my case, the Republican Party, and then you have some of the scandals of, like, say, 2006.
Right.
It definitely taints things. You know, I do think part of, like, here in Washington State, where we are at the moment, you know, the losses that the Republicans sustained in 2006, which were major, they basically lost all levers of power in Washington State in 2006, apart from the Attorney General's race. Or office. That was a result of evangelicals or religious people staying home in 2006 in response to the Foley scandal and other scandals that were tainting the Republican Party, the Abramoff issue. And the feeling was, A, the Republicans hadn't delivered, and B, they're a bunch of crooks like everybody else and a bunch of, you know, immoral people, and so why care? And as a consequence of that, here in Washington State, 575,000 fewer religious people voted in 2006 than voted in 2004. And the consequence of that for the Republican Party was it wiped them out. I mean, it wiped the Republicans out of power in right. Washington State. And that was entirely the consequence of religious people, because you can't lose more than 500,000 religious voters who just didn't vote.
Right.
They didn't vote in 2006. They just stayed home. And as a consequence, the Republicans lost their last hold in the Senate, and they even some of the conservatives that they could have had, I mean, they just lost, they ceased to be a viable party in Washington State. And that was because of the loss of the religious vote.
And how do you rebuild that? If you're talking in 2006, there's been a dissatisfaction with the way that the party was going. The Foley scandal, which was in Florida. It was across the continent, and yet it still has some residual impact here. How do you build spirits back up into the movement? I'm also thinking about this in terms of the Tea Party movement that
right.
is sweeping across the nation now, which is linked to the Republican Party because most people tend to be conservative in that movement, but yet is outside of the Republican Party.
Well, but why is it outside the Republican Party? I mean, I'm not a Tea Party person,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not a big fan of the libertarian side of things,
right?
But which is heavily influenced there. But, you know, Republican principle, conservative principles of finance, you know, I think Karl Rove and George Bush just decided that they were going to not let the Democrats outspend them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just continued on, you know, spending as if there's no tomorrow. And that alienated conservative people. You know, I mean, that alienates religious conservatives because it violates principles of frugality. And it's just, and so, you know, you are going, economic conservatives are often also religious conservatives. Mm-hmm. And while the one side gets emphasized at various times, like at the moment, economics is driving the political process, not social or moral issues,
right.
Generally speaking. But the people who support conservative finances also are predominantly religious conservatives. I mean, that would be an interesting point of study.
Right.
The correspondence between the two. Just like religious conservatives tend to vote Republican, to what extent is there a correlation between economic conservatism and religious conservatism? I would think you'd find correspondence there.
There actually happens to be somebody in this room who's actually studying that
oh,
at this moment. Yeah, working on with some national election study data, looking at the growing gap between regular churchgoers and non-churchgoers to talk about the God gap. It has traditionally been talked about in terms of denominational affiliation,
right.
but more and more we're seeing that denominational affiliation matters less, and your involvement in religion, whether it be Assemblies of God, the Evangelical Methodist or the Catholic Church, those folks tend to look a lot alike politically. And then we're also trying to track this in terms of the economic views of these individuals as well.
And are you finding correspondence?
We're finding, what is interesting is there is a greater tendency toward economic conservatism among the religious conservatisms, although it's not as strong as we project. The most interesting finding coming out of there, and I guess this is going down a course of another podcast, but the most interesting finding is that there has been a steady tracking of regular churchgoers, a couple times a month or more, have becoming more and more conservative, self-identified ideologically, political dimensions, and then less so economic dimensions. Whereas secular individuals, people who don't attend church or maybe a couple times a year, are much more volatile. It's not that they're becoming more liberal. It's that, you know, during the 80s, they're very conservative, but during the mid-90s, they're very liberal, and back and forth and back and forth. And so it seems that the interesting dynamic here is that religious churchgoers, regular churchgoers, tend to be much more stable in their overall values and views than secular folks who seem to be easily blown in the wind. Mm-hmm. So
secularists are gullible.
That might be one way of putting it. So we'll have to see how that. I'm waiting to run the data on the 2008 election, which I think will be an interesting thing to find out about. But let me go back to voter mobilization. 500,000 or more religious voters don't show up in Washington in 2006. Did they come out in 2008? And how would your organizations or your efforts try to bring them out in 2010? In essence, what motivates these people to get out to the polls?
Yeah, well, we haven't yet fully. 2008 did not fully mobilize the church, here, at least here in Washington State. I don't have any hard numbers on that, but just my gut feeling and my sense of it is that it wasn't as strong. And what you did have is a very strong liberal turnout in 2008 in Washington State, in King County, and I think the R71 actually tended to turn out the liberal far more than it did the conservative.
And for our listeners, R71 is?
It was the gay rights legislation.
Right.
It was an initiative, or a referendum rather, to try to roll back everything but marriage for gays.
That was the working title of it, Everything But Marriage. It wasn't a gay marriage amendment, but rather domestic partnership laws, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. All right. And what that did, that primarily succeeded in mobilizing the left. Mm-hmm. And so as a consequence, you know, races were lost all across the state.
Right.
For Republicans primarily. And so it had a negative effect, I think, at the polls rather than a positive effect. You know, the conventional wisdom used to be, you know, throw some red meat out there and you'll get conservatives to show up. But that, I think that was a misread on that one.
That brings up an interesting point, is how you pick and choose the political battles that you want to fight. Because there might be something that you want to take a stand on, say R71, but it could have residual impact in terms of the election of a number of legislatures or for the party that you don't want to get elected. So how do you go about picking and choosing what you want to work with, what you want to emphasize in any given year?
Well, I mean, you do have to give some thought to the political consequences, but that really isn't what drives me so much. I'm more driven by what I perceive as the wisdom of doing it. Even though I voted for R71, I didn't really support it in its opening, in running it. I didn't think it should have been run. Mm-hmm. I didn't think we had the organization to make it happen, and that proved to be correct. I didn't think we had the economic will, the financial will to make it happen, which proved to be correct. And so I just thought it was going to be a disaster, which it was. Mm-hmm. You just decide, is the public with you on this? You can't mm-hmm. govern from a minority position. And the public was not in the mood. I'd done polls, and I just knew where they were on it. And so, there's no point in running an election if you know that the outcome isn't going to be favorable. You're better to just let it sit there.
Right.
And I think you should have some degree of hope of success, fact, you should have a 10% margin before you run an initiative or a referendum on your side, because without the margin, you're not going to win. And because it's harder to run something than it is to oppose it.
How difficult is that in terms of one's moral conscience and trying to put forward an issue that many people will say, well, you know, this issue, I know that it's a losing issue, but, you know, my conscience dictates that I have to go and fight this. Is there some tension there?
There is, but, you know, my saying for that is you should be willing to die on the hill, but you shouldn't want to die on every hill. Mm-hmm. There's lots of things that I don't like that I'm not going to die about, you know, or, you know, just devote myself fully to, because there's a hierarchy of values you've got to deal with and what's the most important thing. And throwing myself into a fight, which I know is going to be a losing fight, makes no sense to me, mm-hmm. because I have other things I can throw myself into that I need to work on. You might say I have, you know, there's only so much bandwidth in the head, mm-hmm. and in the heart, and why fill it up with stuff that's not going to be effective?
I think that's a really great point to end up on, and many what we talk about in political science and in economics as well is the trade-offs that we all engage in terms of what battles we pick and choose to fight and whether we come back and fight again another day. And that might be a topic again for a future podcast here, but today I was speaking with Reverend Joe Featon of the Cedar Park Church in Bothell, Washington, on the issue of religion and politics. If you're interested in some of the links to his church and a few of the things that we discussed about today, please visit us at www.researchonreligion.org, and we look forward to talking to you next week. Thank you, Pastor Joe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.